Tonight, as you probably saw, the title we've given to the evening is Cognitive Theater. The simple reason is that I think that Peter Gelb, in some way, is trying to inspire that at the New York Public Library. I know for my part, when I arrived at the library, I was asked by a reporter to define my mission statement in two words. Whenever you hear people talking about mission statements, you know how religious this country is. And the only way I could define what I do is by talking about cognitive theater. Another way of talking about what we might be talking about tonight is to refer to Werner Herzog's definition of culture. He talks about it as a collective agitation of the mind. I encourage you to join the New York Public Library, become a friend of the New York Public Library. If you do, you support us and you get discounts on these live programs. So please join and become a friend of the library. I also encourage you very warmly, since I'm trying to create a two-way street and not a dead end, but a two-way street between the New York Public Library and the Metropolitan Opera, I encourage you all to become ticket holders, sponsors of the Metropolitan Opera as well. It is a pleasure to welcome to this stage three extremely distinguished directors and the president director of the Metropolitan. It is a pleasure to welcome to this stage Bartlett Scheer. I think I pronounce your name right. I'm not quite sure, with some French names interspersed here. I don't know anymore how to speak correctly. I'm kind of a linguistic monster, who returns to the Met with a new production of Offenbach's Les Contes d'Hoffmann, and I believe is working with a great Nico Muley on an opera as well. A current revival of South Pacific is playing at Lincoln Center, which I saw and which I love. I really encourage you to go and see that. Bartlett Scheer. Patrice Chéreau is one of the greatest directors working today, known for his Ring Cycle, among many things, conducted by Pierre Boulez. And new to the Met this season will be Janáček's The House of the Dead, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen, one of my very favorite conductors, Patrice Chéreau. Director Luc Bondy studied pantomime, and made his debut at the Paris Théâtre Universitaire International, acclaimed for his opera interpretations. Bondy has directed, among many operas, Voice, Così fan tutti, and now, unless you don't know, he has opened to great acclaim of one sort or another. But it is acclaim, nevertheless, and we will talk about that. The Met's 2009-2010 season with his Tosca, Luc Bondy. And last but not least, since taking over as general manager of the Metropolitan Opera in 2006, Peter Gelb has launched a host of initiatives to revitalize opera and connect it to a wider audience. Under his leadership, the company has recruited increased numbers of world-grade theater directors, some of them are on our stage today, secured more performances for top singers, and launched the Met in HD, Live in HD, which presents live performance transmissions in movie theaters around the world. This 2009-2010 season has him presenting more than half a dozen, I believe, new productions of his choosing. It is a pleasure to welcome him tonight, as well as to extend a warm welcome to his parents in the audience. Peter Gelb would like us to see some clips from the performances that are happening now. But before we do, I would like to ask you one question. If you, and any of you can take it in no particular order, if you, since we do have somewhat of a French contingent here, would you agree, in fact, with La Rochefoucauld, that we would all rather be spoken of ill than not spoken at all?
I would be happy to offer a comment on that. Although I was once a young publicist and learned that you know, of course, the expression that press agents are always taught, and I was 17 or 18 when I was one, was that as long as your name is spelled right, that's all that counts. When your name is in the newspaper, I would say that it's really not ultimately relevant whether you are spoken of in a good way or a bad way, if the work that you are doing is good and is accepted by enough people to warrant it to continue. And I think that all of the work that the directors on this podium represent is good work that has won them great fans and acclaim, and that has inspired them to do more work and inspired audiences to wish to see it. And, you know, I'm always mindful, as the head of a theater, which has 4,000 seats, that as we are running a public art form, and that it is necessary to have the public with you in order to continue. And that is what's most important than the words, whether they are ill or not.
Very sage reply. Vous
voulez me dire la phrase?
Mais avec plaisir. En français. Est-ce que j'ai la phrase en anglais, mais est-ce qu'il vaudrait mieux qu'on parle mal de vous plutôt qu'on ne parle pas de vous du tout?
Ça dépend. Depends. It depends for what, you know. Both are true, you know. When you do so, when you make something, you hope. You don't make, when you're very young, you hope you make a scandal or something like this. When you're older, it's not so important. You want to communicate something and not to think about, and not to think too much about. I didn't thought about reaction before. I don't know. You know, the problem is the context where you're coming. You don't know. For me, it was strange to be here after. But I think it's both. You want to be completely quiet, and sometimes you want to talk. It's both. To say something.
So with age, your desire for scandal diminishes?
My desire to?
For scandal.
I don't have a real desire. I had no in my life really desire to this, I must tell you. Never really. I never really had the desire of this. And I think that I tried to express what I'm feeling and not think about the scandal. And I'm very surprised when the people are scandalized, because then I don't understand why, really.
Does that mean that you're not thinking of the public?
No, because at the moment you do it, you think about the thing you do. You have no, you're not thinking, how he's going to think this, and because how, I don't know, I didn't, if you ask me, I didn't know that Tosca was like the Bible in New York.
But now you do.
I saw, now, yes.
Now you definitely do.
I understand. Then when Patrice, when I was very young, and not so much younger than Patrice, I was in Bayreuth, and I understand that for the in Bayreuth, I was lucky to be in the year who was accepted and not anymore the church. But it was like this, the said designer, we have to say, he said, Chapelet told me, it was like this in Bayreuth with Wagner, what I can understand a little bit more. And without being against Puccini, I don't understand why a story was so naughty and so worse, and a terrible story. I like the thrilling, but I cannot understand then for intelligent people, they are scandalized how you make an opera, but if they listen to the what is written in the opera, in the same times you have a guy, he's torturing another guy in another room, trying to make love with a woman, and this, it's wonderful because it's sung and it's a beautiful voice. So it was terrible because it reminded me that George Steiner, the philosopher, told that the guy who led Auschwitz, a famous guy who was leading Auschwitz, he was always listening in the morning Schubert, and in the afternoon put the people in the
in Bluebeard.
Right. So it is like this. I'm surprised that the people are scandalized. If they are scandalized, I couldn't understand that they say, stop this shit music, if they think it, or stop this horrible scene. But the problem that the guy has free woman, a man come to me at the general and say, get a read of this disgusting prostitute. I think, why? They are not disgusting. They are pretty women on the stage. what's happened? He say it, he tells it, they don't know. And they're shocked, they don't know why. And it's very, very strange. It was surprising. More I cannot say.
Well, you've started by saying quite a lot, but...
Well, I have an 8-month-old daughter, and when she wakes up in the morning and smiles at me beautifully and looking for mirroring, I boo her very loudly.
What? That is very
sorry.
Helpful.
Well, and,
no, I mean,
I think that our natural tendency is not to wish to expect ill. We don't expect it. Mm. We in our normal pattern of growing and developing, we want to make something that people, of course, respond to, whether in a good way or a bad way. So I always think when booing or something like that is going on, that there's another level at which the experience is happening that seems extra or outside of the normal thing. So there's often some weird thing that can be happening that's interesting, but it's never something that I would that any normal artist that I know is eliciting or trying to demand. They might try to shock, they might try to, I don't know, but that's usually a very young thing in your career. But if you're...
But none of us is sufficiently young on this stage to wish that.
There you are.
Yeah.
So, I don't think it's a natural inclination to try to provoke it, or wish ill, or seek illness in others. But I don't know. That's it.
Patrice Chéreau.
What is the question?
Well, to some extent, what let me. Rephrase or move on, as it were. To some extent, what has happened in the recent weeks at the Metropolitan is that you have elicited a lot of passions, profound passions. One might even talk about that one of the things your production has elicited is a passion for opera. Is that true?
Do I have to answer for him?
Yes.
Well, I don't know. I knew a very long time ago, 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, I knew I provoked a huge scandal in Bayreuth, you know. And I think, first of all, I remember that my reaction at that time was, first of all, I'm not making this job for that people are talking about me. Well, you are not. That is not the purpose. The purpose is you want to create something on stage. You want to tell stories, and to let the people, to allow the people to think about the story and to have emotions and so on and so on. Then we, Luc and I, we are not exactly opera goers. You know, we are not. We are coming from the theater and we're coming from the films. That means that we are interested in making opera. Not because we like opera, I must say, but only because we're interested in telling a story with the music and telling a story with two texts, you know, the text of the libretto and the text of the music. I was interesting long time ago when I started to make my first opera, thinking that I could could follow or find an utopic, utopia, you say?
Yeah.
Utopia, that a theater could be more theatrical because of the music, it could be more responsible, because it's always interesting. When we come from the theater, it's always interesting to work on a music with a conductor, because suddenly the time is measured. Suddenly you are not in this absence, apparent absence of freedom. You have a lot of freedom, because suddenly you have I was interested in making an opera. I was interested with The Ring in working with Pierre Boulez, for example, interesting in analyzing the work with Pierre Boulez and finding things that Wagner gave me and that the theater, for example, from Shakespeare couldn't give me because we don't have the music. So I was interested in going forward, further, more than the theater I was doing. You cannot have a desire of scandal, you know. I was surprised 30 years ago. Now it's not a scandal anymore because the DVD is re-given and given and given, but I was really surprised myself about this scandal from Bayreuth. Totally surprised and quite calm because the fight or the difficulty was at the day of the premiere when the people discovered the ring, the fight was behind me. I finished the battle. The battle was to convince the singers, and they were convinced, and to try a way of telling the story, and to try a way, the most honest way to tell the story. And I was so surprised because then I discovered 3 years later that somebody told me, but you know, there is so much theater in your production that we cannot listen to the music anymore. And I think it was good. It was exactly what it was about. I tried just to rediscover something that Wagner asked me to do, but to make theater with his drama. That's it.
And what is booed, we may come back to this later, but what is booed one season take certain productions of Robert Wilson and others is loved the next season, and what is booed on opening night might be loved a week later. I mean, I saw your production yesterday on a DVD because I wasn't able to go to the production last week, and I... We'll come to that, but I just can't quite understand all the fuss.
Yeah, I want to tell you only a short thing. That I think there is also a audio and a linguistic problem. If you make boo, if you are 10 people who are 50, 100 make boo, and you have 10 who make bravo, you never hear bravo because bravo have the air. You know, bravo. But boo is extraordinary. And we don't have...
This is very, very louder and efficient. You know, this is very interesting.
Loud and very. But we don't have this. So I remember when I was a very young assistant in Hamburg, in very much years, and I remember there was a play who was shocking an old woman, and everybody clapped, and the old woman like, boo. And everybody stopped to clap because this boo was more important. So this, you must think about it.
Well, you know, I'm thinking next season of doing an event here at the library on applause. Yeah. On applause and clapping, because my father in 1933 in Vienna was a claquette at the opera. I don't know how you call that. So, you know, I can clap very loudly.
Why don't you?
But maybe the boo is even louder than the clap. I am thinking of...
But he was getting paid for doing that.
Yes,
it was a job.
Yes.
There were about 10 or 12... Yes. And he's 91 years old now, and he still can clap pretty loud. I clap louder than he does, but he that's a good clap. Huh? If ever you need me, Peter, hire me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Peter had to pay people for this.
Right.
And it was not happen.
No.
So I was really unhappy.
So I'm available. But what I would like to do is invert things a little bit. I would like to start by showing a clip of the opera that's forthcoming here at the Metropolitan, the Janáček House of the Dead, and have both of you say something about it. We can watch it on this monitor. Can we bring down the lights? Is that possible? No, we can't. But okay. Let's watch what... Perhaps you could tell us a little.
All these people, you have killed the most effective effect, the most important effect of the whole play, production, you know. Yes.
Not my choice.
No, no.
You're not supposed to say that.
Okay. No, there are the good moments. But let's.
I know.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you can say something about what drew you to, since theatre is the origin of your passions, but not opera. What drew you to this particular opera? And perhaps you can contextualize a little bit what we just saw.
Well, first of all, it's, you know, you never really choose your opera. You get an offer. The offer came from Luc, in the Vienna Festival. And they asked me if I accept to do House of the Dead by Jan Hacek with Pierre Boulez at that time. And I accepted, of course, because I wanted to work again with Pierre. And I was interested by that Pierre wanted to do this one. He never did Jan Hacek and for his last opera, because he decided not to do it, not to do another opera anymore. He wanted to analyze, to try to understand what was this music. And I listened to the opera, and I was so surprised and so impressed, because it's a beautiful and it's an amazing opera. First of all, it's an opera based on a book by Dostoevsky. It's very rare. It never happened. A book that Dostoevsky wrote after he was in camp in Siberia for 4 years. And it's a beautiful book about the prison. It's a beautiful book about a camp, because it's full. You see, in a camp in Siberia in winter, so suddenly it happens exactly the opposite that you can think at the beginning. It's not sad. It's not desperate. It is only full of hope, only full of life, full another life than, but sometimes the same that we are living. And sometimes with other rules, but sometimes with the same rules we have in the society. It's a parallel society, a prison, full of love, because they are all these people are trying to explain for the first time in their life, trying to explain how they kill, how they become killers. And Jan Hacek is never judging them. Dostoevsky neither. But Jan Hacek is never judging them. He says there is always, He wrote on the first page of the score a beautiful line from Dostoevsky: "In every human soul, a spark of God." That means that even if the worst people, on the worst person, even on the killer, even the people who were criminals, there is something you can love, or you can still understand, and they are human beings. That means that it's very simple, and with an extremely powerful music, with a huge lot of people, because there's many stories. Of course, there is no real love story, you know, like in a normal opera. There is not a story, love story between the tenor and the soprano, because we don't have soprano. So we have only men, almost, with the prostitute. But they are telling the story. The love is in there, because they are telling that they killed sometimes, most of the time, for love, and they killed because they want to be respected. They wanted to be. So in other words, it's a totally unusual opera, and that's why I like
and,
to do it.
And Dostoevsky wrote the book, if I remember right, after being condemned to death.
After being condemned to death, well, it happened something worse with him. He was condemned to death, and then on the day of Christmas of 1859, he went to in front of the people who was should shout him, the peloton shoot him, and then at the last moment they pretend to do it and they stop. And he went 4 years in Siberia, and then he went 2 years more, and he wrote immediately after. He wrote the book immediately after. And he became a writer after this book. All the big book by Dostoevsky are written just afterwards, just coming back from this humanity, coming back from the description of this beautiful, incredible mankind. And it never happened in an opera. It never happened such an incredible and powerful music as you can hear. And it's something the really totally unusual. That's why it's an item, so strange item, but beautiful and powerful.
Peter, say something about the clip we saw and also about your relationship in choosing directors for operas.
Well, you know, in the case of these directors, it's not so much that I'm choosing them. They are choosing what they want to do. And I am the happy recipient of their work. In the case of Patrice's House of the Dead, when I was appointed to my position in the fall of 2004, and I started gearing up for my job in 2005, one of the first things I did, of course, was to look at the future seasons of the Met and think about how I could revive interest in the Met and draw in new audiences. And it begins and ends with what we put on the stage, and that involves a jigsaw puzzle full of pieces, but the most important pieces are how to either take masterpieces of the repertory and breathe new life in them. I can't do that. Only the directors can. In the case of Tosca, in the case of Tales of Hoffman that Bart is directing, that is what we're hoping to accomplish. And also to expand the repertory. This piece, this brilliant piece of Janáček's, has never been performed at the Metropolitan Opera House. And the idea of having Patrice, who had never worked at the Met,
Esa-Pekka, who never worked.
Right, none of these directors had ever worked at the Met before. And I, you know, the biggest challenge I had in trying to convince them to work at the Met was to persuade them that the Met, which was known, it was, you know, famous for being the greatest house of musical performances in opera, but not a place sympathetic to directors' work in recent decades, to persuade them that the Met would be an hospitable and supportive institution for their work. So I had a lot of convincing to do back then. And in the case of House of the Dead, I actually was approached by, I sort of had an open kind of agenda of what I wanted to do. I wanted to have the greatest directors. I wanted to have new repertory. I wanted to have the greatest stars. I wanted to have, you know, the best of all possible worlds of theater and opera on the stage, one show after another. And I was open to anything, any good suggestion, and open to and going and pursuing things as well. But I remember being approached by Stefan Listner, who's now the head of La Scala, who at the time was running the and still was involved with the Vienna Festival.
Yeah, you mean the music part.
The music part. Under Luke, who was the boss.
No, it doesn't matter.
But Stefan Listner came to me and said to me, would you be interested in joining the Vienna Festwochen and the X Festival in this production? And I immediately said, if it's directed by Patrice Chéreau, I'm in. in this project. And then, of course, it wasn't quite that simple. We had to. I met with Patrice numerous times. Pierre Boulez, who was going to be 85 at the time we're doing this, or already was 85, didn't want to come with the production to New York. He felt he, as he said to me, he was too old to spend such a long period of time here. We had to find somebody who, a conductor who would be up to this task, and in Esa Pekka Salonen, we have, you know, the most marvelous choice, because he also is making his debut at the Met, is a great champion of 20th century work, and I'm sure Pierre himself would agree is probably the best person to conduct it if he can't do it. So I agreed to this production long before it was actually produced. I was very happy when I was sitting in the theater in Vienna in 2006 or 2007 at the premiere and saw this masterpiece in front of me. And because even when you have the best plans, and you know, with all these great directors and all their and having all the greatest planning and inspiration, and sometimes things don't always work out the way they want them to. But that's true. But this did, and certainly. It's a masterpiece. And what's very exciting, I think, for us at the Met, and I think for Patrice too, is that it is being, even though he has presented it now in three different theaters, we're the fourth theater to have it, he really is approaching it as a fresh production.
What's the difference?
Well, new cast members.
And yeah. What's the difference?
New conductor.
Between these. This production and the three ones that were before.
What is always a difference when you start working again, you know? The job is not to repeating exactly what you did. The job is to say where I failed or where was wrong, and sometimes for example, long time ago, The Ring was much better in Bayreuth on the third year, you know. Than in the first, so here it's also to not only to refresh and to change many things with the help of a new cast, a beautiful cast I have here, and I think it will be a quite different.
So it has something to do with rereading, but it has also something to do with adapting it for an American audience.
I don't think it has to do with adapting it for an American audience at all. It has nothing to do with that. No. But what I think each of these directors, having observed their work closely, what they all do is they draw from the talents of their cast to revise and adapt the characterizations that they're putting on the stage. And if they have a singer who has something to offer that is special, they incorporate that into the realization on the stage.
Yes, and to change immediately the point of view, you know, that I'm working these days with Peter Mattei, who never made the production, and suddenly I discover new things, other things in a huge part he has, and also we are revisiting everything, you know. We have actors also in this opera. We have 20 actors, and of course, working with American actors is totally different than working with Austrian one. So everything is different. We have another energy on stage, and you have also the energy of the theater himself where you are working, and everything changes. You are not the same person, and also you miss many things sometimes in the first production.
And you yourself have aged, so in some way you reread.
That's the less pleasant side of the revival, you know.
But
yes, I'm getting older, but
it has to do with rereading.
Yes, rereading, but you can also be worse than the first.
Definitely,
time. You have never to forget that. It could be quite possible to make a terrible revival. So, you don't have to change for changing. It's just because suddenly. You understand that rereading the book of Dostoevsky by Dostoevsky, for example, or here listening to music in a different tempo, that suddenly you have other options to do, and you said, "Oh, that I didn't understand the first time, but now I understand how to do," because you know it's not a matter of interpretation; it's just a matter of this opera is a huge collage of many, many, many stories. You have to find something. It's a strange case that you have to find a bridge, you have to find an arc, you have to build sometimes yourself as a director the arc of the opera, and that is just to avoid that to have only vignette or to have only small images, you know. So you have to create something larger than this opera, and of course it has to do with the tempo of the conductor. So it's an incredibly interesting work. Just remaking again the same production wouldn't be interesting, but working again is interesting.
Build the arc of the opera, and you're also very interested, Bart, in the whole notion of interpretation.
Yeah.
Say something about interpretation and why, in effect, an opera text like the Tosca, a libretto, might not be comparable to a sacrosanct text like the Bible.
Oh, there's a question. It's interesting. I saw the Tosca, so and I have a lot of friends who love Tosca very much, and I've had very intense conversations with them. And I couldn't for the life of me. It's one of those weird experiences, because I enjoyed it tremendously. I quite loved it very much. But I couldn't for the life of me reconcile the experience I had without preconceived sensibility and the experience they were having. There was this big object in the middle, which was the 50 Toscas they knew.
Which you didn't know?
Which I did not know. So there's a very complex...
So ignorance is bliss.
There's a very Well, it's not a question of ignorance is bliss, because then I would ask questions about why they were so upset or what upset them, you know, whether it's the prostitutes in the beginning or how Scarpia is seen or all that. And every one of... It's not a... There's a weird experience in interpretation anytime you get to a finality or a truth with a capital T about interpretation. Of course... It's the same problem in religion, you know. If you believe your religion is completely the only way, and you run into another religion, you're going to have a problem. And so I'm not meaning to be oblique or strange. It's just I couldn't reconcile the experience I was having, which was experiencing it as a tremendously beautiful opera and in a really rich and interesting interpretation, against the extra experience somebody was having, putting their own impressions between them and the work they were seeing. And saying, if there aren't two candles there. When I was seeing it, I don't know the opera very well, but I could audibly hear right before one moment the word candle many times. Audibly heard the word, and I was like, what are they talking about? From over around me. And
even before the word boo, the word candle.
No, yeah. There was no booing the day I saw it at all. I think that's a self-interested expression of ownership, a boo. So... But it's just an interesting experience to hear that. So interpretation. So if you see something like House of the Dead, which nobody knows very well, they come to it with a kind of openness. Versus
much
something
harder
else.
To see something that is so well
known. The same
known.
Thing can happen if it's South Pacific. I mean, there are very intense interpreters of those particular musicals as well, and there's sometimes tension between the two. But it's just a weird experience. It's more about the audience than it's about the interpretation. That experience, I think.
So how did you, since we can't see Leconte, the Hoffman's Tales yet, because it isn't quite ready for showing, we're going to be showing an extract now of Barbiere di Siviglia.
Okay.
So tell us something about...
It's very different than House of the Dead, I have to say. just so everybody's aware of that.
If you could make some kind of a bridge, an arc between House of the Dead and Barbiere di... No. But...
Peter Mattei's in both.
Okay. Yes. Tell us something about this particular...
Hoffman is, I don't know how to say it, but Hoffman is a series of stories, and the problem for me is how to make them connect. And often people...
That is the bridge.
Yeah, that's the bridge. For me, the connection...
That's the storytelling.
For me, the connection I'm drawing, and I can do this very quickly, is I'm more attracted to Offenbach than I am to Hoffman. So the question I'm asking is about Offenbach as a Jew... who was an outsider, who never felt accepted inside of his own, as an artist. He was a light kind of musical writer, and then was writing this opera to declare his, to try to find his way into the group, or to find his, and I'm interested in outsiderness, and I'm interested in that in Hoffman as a subconscious understanding of what Offenbach was grappling with, whether he was aware of it or not. So it drew me into the world of Kafka, more to understand, and when you go to make love to somebody, it's often an effort to be accepted. So when you
I've never thought of it that way.
If you look at the different women he's trying to find acceptance through, they're outside his group. They're the actress, the whatever. And so it's an exploration of that as a way, unfinished, to find a line between what is the engine for Hoffman / Offenbach, as a way of exploring why it is that what it is that he is seeking through these women and through as an artist and all those things. So the context of Kafka then leads me to the strangeness of the 20s, and also, which was an interesting time in writing because narrative is kind of coming apart then in any case in that era of writing. And so that's all the link. That's the simple version of the link.
Now going back in time to Barbieri di Sevilla, which is the clip we will see, contextualize a little bit your work with Barbieri di Sevilla and what attracted you to that particular opera.
Well, I'm attracted to Beaumarchais and the politics of the opera, which are very, very subtle, and were probably declared through space, through the way of looking at the space at the Met differently, as a way of changing the relationship of the audience to the experience, in the same way Beaumarchais was trying to change the relationship of the rising bourgeois or the Figaro character. And so there was a way of trying to intersect the two. It is grounded in some ways in Commedia, but even Beaumarchais was pushing past Commedia. And so it's a very it's a spatial exploration, and it's very important to have that long aria at the end. And at the time I did it, we were living in the Bush years. Please don't worry if I say anything that upsets you. And there's an interesting thing about the aria, about psychologically allowing yourself to be free of tyranny, for the Count to let himself change his assumptions. And we were in a very complex time around that era, which was only 4 years ago, where we were trapped between our perceptions of where we were. So that those were all subconscious layers of how I was looking at it.
Let's look at the clip.
And it's funny, sort of.
L'arma sul corpo della città, l'arma. La 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 la. Presto, bottega che la maglia, presto. La 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 la.
At the ending there?
You know, the end of that act's pretty crazy. And the text talks about an anvil's pressing against my brain. So there's an anvil. And a very big one.
Big
and
one.
It crushes some pumpkins, which are brain-sized.
I saw it on stage today, a huge one.
Yeah, it's very big.
Yeah, very, very big.
Luke, do you know that Have you seen that production?
No, but I
saw you looking
that
very...
I'm coming out from a rehearsal evening late, and I was going through the front and of the opera, and I saw very much people sitting. So I sit a little bit, and I was looking. It was just the end. I was too late.
Yeah.
But it was very funny, and it was a good way to go out of an opera, and not to go in the very sad street, Amsterdam or Benz, I don't know, but to coming out on this side and see all the people sitting there and looking and listening. And so it was a very, very extraordinary experience. So it was with this opera my experience.
Are you about to say something?
No.
No.
I would just like to say that one of the marvelous things about this production is Barbara Seville has been a staple of the repertoire at the Met for many, many years. And this production that Bart created actually had people laughing as if they were seeing a play, a funny play. And that is something, several members of our board commented to me that they never realized that this piece is actually funny. And
did they say it in an approving way?
Yeah. No, that was a good thing.
Yeah,
it was a good thing. And I think, you know, what's wonderful about Bart's work and all of Patrice's and Luc's work is that they are, you always hear them saying, and they always say to me, we're just trying to tell a story. And a story, you know, clearly, the way a good theater director approaches a play. And, you know, the difference here is it's much more complicated because there's singing involved, too. So they have to not only tell a story, but also you know, honor the musical values and difficulties and challenges of singers who have all kinds of technical issues in order to be able to produce their voices. And but the idea that Barber could actually be funny on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera was somewhat of a revelation. And the you know, even just the way Bard approached it physically, you know, you saw on that video that there is a stage that extends, a passerelle that goes into the audience. This is not something so revolutionary, but at the Met it was. That was the first time in the history of the Metropolitan Opera House that there ever had been a passerelle extending from the stage. So
it doesn't take much to...
That's what I mean by a spatial transformation, and to change the physical relationship in relationship to the politics of the piece. But there's a relationship between space and politics.
But I think that
hierarchy. Mm. So,
but I was just going to say, I think that the idea that the story came alive and across in such a, you know, vivid, compelling way through this production is not that different than what, although Tosca is not a comedy, is what Luc was attempting to do with Tosca, which was to, you know, basically tell a story in a modern psychological way.
Before, psychologically, though, to
an audience today that is not. I mean, the problem of the way in which Tosca has been produced so often in the past has been really, as was said, sort of honoring the instructions in the libretto, as if it was some kind of a religious manuscript that had to be followed, and what Luc has done is to not follow these instructions, which were, I'm sure, if Puccini were alive today, he would not want to be followed, because
we can't know, but
he would want his piece, though, I think, to be presented in a way that would ring true to a modern audience.
I'm sure Luc is very eager to speak about Tosca, but no. Just before you do, you were talking about staples of the Metropolitan Opera, and you were talking about Rossini, Barbieri. Certainly one of the staples of the opera house has been for 25 years, and let's mention him by name, was Zeffirelli's Tosca. Peter Gelb, I mean, what were you thinking? What were you thinking about by starting your season with more than half a dozen new operas and doing away, as it were, with Zeffirelli? Why do you think that was a good move, and do you regret it now?
I don't regret it, but I can tell you that, you know, just if you do the mathematics, it's impossible to run any theater with the same productions forever. And when I took over the Metropolitan Opera, it was losing its audience, and its audience was aging. And clearly, the only way to keep an aging art form and an opera house with many very ancient productions alive and interesting for a public, a new public, as well as the older public, is to present new productions. You can't do it any other way. And you know, I'm sure there are many people who believe, who think that it's a crime to have replaced the Zeffirelli production. But the answer, I don't know what the answer is for them. So if it didn't happen this year, when would it happen? 5 years from now? 10 years from now? 50 years from now? 100 years from now? At some point, it would have to go. And you know, what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do with my colleagues at the Met, is to keep this theater alive and vibrant and interesting.
And one of the ways of keeping a younger audience coming is to do away with Zeffirelli. Is that? No,
I don't think it's a question of doing away with Zeffirelli. It's a question of doing something new, and not accepting the old.
Excuse me, I want to say something. I hope you agree, all my colleagues. But I want to say you, it's important that 3-4 years for performance is very old for us. I feel if I don't want it, would not like to imagine that my Tosca becomes 25-year-old. I think in 4 years it's enough, 3 years. Because I don't think, the problem is that the things are changing, the feeling is changing, people are changing, the way to accept is changing, everything is changing. So I don't think you have to sit down on something and say it's yours. You know, I didn't talk very much about it because I don't know him and I never saw his Tosca. The idea that I would sitting on something I did and say to another colleague, why you do this, it for me unbelievable, because first it was Puccini and never Zeffirelli who write this. And it's the first is the composer who did this and the guy who made it. So how you can sit down of a work, imagine that you are inventing this work for the world. And this is arrogance who is senile, gaga. And I think it's only the newspaper who tried, because today is a day of event. Everything has to be an event over what you do. And I think it's so sad to imagine that the event of a work I did, how many works I did, was that the event of this work is the fight between this guy and me. I don't care about this. I don't want this. And to imagine this, how somebody takes over, this is completely not really in the head. Something doesn't work. And it doesn't work that the people say you hear it. And last day I was with one of a good friend of me to see somebody, and then he said, well, you know, he's a good friend of Zeffirelli. I say, and what? So, you know, this is stupid. Excuse me.
If I may just add one thing, because I really want to make something clear. You know, Zeffirelli is responsible for some wonderful productions at the Met. He started, his earliest production at the Met, I guess, is the Falstaff from 1964. He has made fantastic productions. But the point is, this art form has to move along in order to stay alive. You know, Michael Grandage is directing a new Hamlet that just came here. Nobody's shocked at the idea that there's a new Hamlet. There has to be a new Hamlet. There have to be many new Hamlets. And there have to be many new productions of Tosca and Aida. And, you know, these pieces have to be replenished and refreshed. Not to say that they weren't great in their time.
I think it's
I think it's a problem of time. You know, it's a lot of people holding on to a memory they have of the Met that's very intense and very personal. And I think that time is a complicated thing. I think it would be interesting if you could go back in a time capsule and see the original Tosca 25 years ago, and then see it, whatever, 4 years ago that it was done again, and wonder whether you're having the same experience anyway. I mean, these things change so deeply, and there is really no chance, no choice, except for the wheel of time is going to keep marching ahead, and we have to reinvigorate them. We have to rethink them. We have to go back to them. It's a requirement of being human to rethink and move forward. It won't always be a perfect experience, but the idea that they get held in a place, it's mostly hard to let go of time or to realize time is moving ahead. And some people can't do it so easily.
But it sounds as though they can particularly not do it when it comes to certain works of art and when it comes to certain forms of art like opera. And this immediately brings a question to mind that is on many people's mind is, you know, the relevance of opera altogether and how to make it come alive. I mean, I certainly battle with this myself here at the library. I always wonder how much this library weighs. You know, quite literally.
Yeah, nobody. It's very, 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 very interesting that people still care.
Well, that
because
is what,
in fact,
what the
other problem is that in the rest of the culture, the rest of the culture, you can barely hold on to a line of anything. And at least the wonderful, fantastic thing about the Met is how deeply people care. You actually feel like there is a line of experience, and there is a reaction, and a move forward, and a move back, and that is much more comforting, even through booing or through whatever, than the idea that nobody can remember anything from 20 minutes ago.
That's why we have Twitter. But
exactly.
kind of a, you know, the new form of haiku. But do you think people do you think people care? You seem to, as Bart was talking, your head was going left and right.
The problem could be a little bit different. The problem is that many years and the most of the time, the director who makes opera are lazy, so. Then when they are lazy, they don't touch nothing on the opera, and the singer are standing here on the front. They move everything, if you can imagine, background. The people don't care. They stand there, and they move things and so. And the people don't really care about it. And I think what makes the people always strange is when the singer, you try with the singer to make a relation. You cannot really make it, but you try to make something. And only this case to go out, jump out of a genre and to go to try to make this genre in another way to live, it's shocking. It's shocking when a singer makes something who is not shocking years after. I saw Mostel, because I learned very much when I was seeing, when I was singing in Bayreuth, The Ring, it was the first time you see people. It was before in Germany, was very famous, Felsenstein, who tried this, many things. The way to approach opera and to approach it humanly, with humanity, and not only with stereotype. And the problem is that music, you know, music is dangerous and wonderful, because with the music, the most of the operas you see in the world is a success. You must know the people are always clapping, because the music has a moment who is metaphysical and sensual. In theater, you're very fast, completely tired and exhausted. In opera, when you sleep, you can hear wonderful music also. And it's like this. And I think the question that the expression exists, certainly, in the opera, did disturb the people. And this is the first point, not what kind of interpretation. Because I tell you very shortly, this thing about the candles, you know the candle? It was, let me tell you the problem. Puccini saw a performance with Sarah Bernhardt, and she was inventing this on the stage. It was perhaps on this night a very good idea. I think it was an awful idea, but it was with Sarah Bernhardt together a good idea, and he wrote it in the score. But then you can imagine this is not a very original invention of the composer. And it's a repetition of Sarah Bernhardt. And the people don't know this. From the play, from Sardou. The people don't know this. And the guy who say, Tosca, you make me forget God, and take Marie in his hand, everybody's shocked because they don't hear, they don't listen anymore what is told in the things. And this is the problem.
So part of your goal role is to make people listen in a new way.
Yes, and I'm a little bit. I love to read, and I love to
sometimes to read the word and to see what they are talking about, yeah. What they are saying, how they answer to each other. Just that sometimes.
But I think that's also the danger of having, you know, in the case of the production that was there for being there for 25 years, it became more of a kind of a decorative presentation of the piece, and really the story suffered as a result.
But people loved it.
And this is a very perverse thing. Good. Excuse
don't
me.
Keep up. What? It's fantastic. It's fantastic that they loved it, but it doesn't prove anything. Yeah, I mean, not everybody loved it, but it doesn't prove
most people
anything.
Loved it.
Well, I think people loved it because they were used to it.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's very beautiful. It is to the most minute detail a representation of actual places in Rome, and it looks very, it's very beautiful.
They don't only love it, they recognize it. They recognize something they knew already. I think during the Ring, they hated my Ring in 76, but then they hated the next one because they wanted mine in 80. You know, yes, after 5 years, they were getting used to it, and they loved it.
So you see,
they didn't want to have it away, to take it away.
So if we give 4 years to your Tosca, in a year from now, people will adore it.
I know.
But then there will be the time to stop, because I agree with you.
After
5 years, you have to keep away and make another production.
But the problem is, if you have a director you can trust, but if you have not a director you can trust, you have not the rights, and then he say, oh, we take this production, and you cannot say no. You must say no contractually normally, because that's the only possibility to stop it, you know. Because you're right, we must stop.
The opera form is so difficult, though, because people do. I mean, this is something that one feels, and I think that's probably part of the problem you have with an aging population coming to the Met, is people are, the people who saw Zeffirelli's production 25 years are still coming to that production today, or until recently, until you took over, and they're holding on to it. In other art forms, I'm thinking particularly, let's say, in jazz, and one of the stories that I've always loved in Miles Davis, a friend of mine once knew Miles Davis, and he went to a concert of Miles Davis and got an extra ticket for a friend of his, and Miles said to him, What else can I do for you but give you a ticket? And this friend said, you know, my friend loves My Funny Valentine. And Miles Davis told him, tell your friend to buy the record.
My Tosca is another problem. The Tosca is a double opera. It's a wonderful and an awful opera at the same time. And I think I didn't want it, but I put the awful things in. Because it's the opera is crazy good. I like it because there are many deeply reasons, but it's also, I know there's moments that are completely stupid. And I did it in a way I did, perhaps you see the stupid moment. And there's a reason that the people discovering what the director is covering years and years with very much details and very much things to put on it, cover the opera with too much decor, and so you don't see that what happened.
I mean, it's like sauce in certain dishes.
Yes, to put a church sauce and the sauce like this, and the sauce of suicide, and the sauce of, and everybody is there. Everybody waits when she jumps down. She say how she jumps, and you as a director, you know, an actress is going to jump on a mattress, and perhaps she jumps again.
I remember Montserrat Caballé jumping up too high.
Caballé
walked off. She didn't jump.
Okay,
is a very modern thing, but I think this is a problem.
Let's see a clip from your production.
Io tenni la promessa.
Non ancora. voglio un salvacondotto onde fuggir dallo stato con lui.
Partir dunque volete?
Sì, per sempre.
Si adempi al volere vostro.
Detail did you notice at one moment you spoke to Peter? You saw something.
Tomorrow they're going to see blood. This is not here because they had afraid. This is a detailed technical detail. And there are something, you know, when you see it near, it's everything are different. You know.
Look, but it's always changing.
Yeah, so
perfect.
Would like to change the hands and things like this. It's like this.
But she kills him. Is it written in the opera?
Kills him.
Yes, she does kill him. Yeah.
But normally she kills him standing.
I know.
But here she lies, yes. And it's not easy, but she comes in the knife. She's like this, and he comes like this. Normally the people expect she stands, and then he comes, and then she kills. But I thought it's better that she lies, and he comes, and normally it's...
And they don't expect that she has already gotten the knife ahead of time.
Excuse me, the knife she gathered here, you get it two times, but you don't see it. It was this famous aria, Visidate, and I say, you must try to discover the knife before, in Visidate, how you say how innocent you are. And you're the most biggest innocence you never saw. And they say, in the same time, you discover the knife, and then you must put it away. Because the idea of the libretto is so stupid that she finds the knife at the moment he kills him. I can't suppose. It's so stupid for storytelling and so. It's not good. So I prepared it a little bit. It's like the jump down. We're very much criticizing that I show that after the killing, she's on the window and think about jumping down. And I say, because I wanted to something to prepare and not to make, because it's need now, we need this and we need this. And I know the letters between Puccini and Sardou is incredible, because Sardou never agreed. Puccini wanted different things. He never agreed with the dead and things like this. It's only when you follow, sometimes you discover things. It's not to be better and to be more. It's not original. I'm very, very angry that the people consider so special. So nothing special. It's opera. It's only a little bit.
How do you mean that?
It's better.
How do you mean that? Nothing is special. It's only opera.
No, I mean, you know, it's for me. I don't think that it's there are difference of level of operas and way of operas. And this is a very trivial story. It's good. It's a very thrilling story. And the music is thrilling, but it is not Alban Berg. I love Schoenberg. I love Puccini, and he was, you know, who was his discovered from Schoenberg was a fan of Puccini. There was always fight about. I think it's a great thing, but there's like Salome, Tosca, there are things like this. They are very emphatic, and they are, in a way, opera, how you cannot imagine a different opera. The top of the idea of opera is Tosca. It's a kind of top. But I don't think it's only good. It's very good, but not only. And the people are true. No, well, I told you.
Well, were you, I mean, it's a question one must ask you. Were you surprised at the reaction?
Stop with the reaction of the audience.
Well, but why? But why? Do you not care?
Not totally.
No, not totally.
No. I can see when they are angry, but I can see when they like.
Okay, so let's forget the audience for a moment. Let's talk about.
We don't forget the audience. No. We never forget the audience. No, no. Yeah. We never forget the audience. But
well, you told me to stop with the audience.
So yes, let's. But sometimes we can disagree with her.
Okay, we can disagree with her, but sometimes, we.
And they can disagree with us.
Of course, of course. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, Luc Bondy, how you felt and feel about the reaction of the critics, because the critics.
There was so different, but I didn't. I must tell you the truth, that I didn't. I only when somebody told me it's a good critic, I wrote that it's bad.
Very,
I didn't.
Very wise policy.
And I didn't be really because you must imagine you come on the stage, and you have 1,000 people. Wow! Again. Then you don't care anymore, and it's a problem. I was pleased that it was finished, and I was pleased. It was a big work. It was very hard work, and I was pleased it's finished. You know, and then the reaction. I was scandalized that they are so scandalized.
That's
this
right.
Scandalizing
yeah.
me.
So there's a. It reminds me of that wonderful Lessing line where.
I think I would not want to scandalize. If this is an opera to scandalize, I don't know what's happening.
But I think, you know, one thing one must not forget, though, is that, and Luc said this earlier, you know, the fact that there is a contingent of people in the audience booing does not mean that many people did not enjoy this opera very, very much. And since I've been at the Met, this is the only production which prompts people to come up to me on the street and say they liked it so much. So many people love this production.
And this happened with me.
And you know, I think the fact that it's got bad reviews in New York is unfortunate. But the public is coming to it. It's completely sold out. The fall performances and they like it. And they don't, you know, they don't have him to boo on the stage after the first night. So they applaud only.
I had people who come to me and say, I liked it.
You know, I think one of the things that's quite interesting about the, for me personally, about the reaction to this is that it's in hearing what people say about it, the people who don't like it, it seems that the sin that was committed here was that, for those people who don't like it, is that it is too raw and gritty and real, and that what would have been, I think, accepted if for those people who would have accepted anything to replace that, really, would have been something that would have been very symbolic and not realistic. The realism of this, I think, is what, combined with the fact that it replaces Zeffirelli, is what is so offensive to those people who don't like it. And it's also exactly what is why the reason why those people who do like it.
There's the chance of the House of Dead, who never been done, is a great music, I think. And it's very, I'm very proud because I'm a part of this production as a producer. And you see, when you see Janáček, the people, how they behave on stage, the simplicity of how people are on stage. And this is something, why we don't do this in, also in the opera who's in the 19th century, you know? The kind of that you recognize over the music, but the music helps you to recognize human people. They not be, must be cliché because they sing. And you know, the big problem of the opera is that the people, they mixed tradition with laziness. They are lazy. And tradition and lazy is, are two different things. That's habitude, and people are lazy normally who makes opera. They say, do. And if you work and you see details, you see singers. In House of Dead, you see singers. But it's marvelous to see a singer in the simplicity of the gesture, because it's possible. You know, the singer, they love this. Normally the singer, they are very pleased with you when you say, keep away this hand and do that. They are very pleased. They are very pleased about working with them. This was the people notice.
It's also cultural. You know, it's a little weird. Americans don't boo a lot. I did an opera in Salzburg, and every production I went to, they booed all the time. So, but yeah. But Americans don't boo a lot. It's a very uncertain time culturally and politically and humanly. And there's a lot of anxiety. And change is a very complicated thing for people to handle. That's so true. The idea of change, because Schiaffarelli was something they love or cherished, and the idea that it's being pushed into change, no matter what the nature of it is, particularly now, is very complex for people. And particularly in New York, where it's very uncertain, you know, time in general, economically and politically. And so the reactionary forces, meaning reacting violently or loudly to something they don't know, are very interesting. I think it's much better when it's loud and when it is voluble than when it's quiet and under the surface. So because it's doing a good thing and creating a good conversation about the nature of what we're doing, and people care enough to say something loud, which is different than when it's secret and complicated. And that so in the conversational terms, it seems to me a sign of great health and expression, even and in transaction between the audience and the event. So I don't know, but
well, in closing, I'd like to ask you a little bit about a very broad question, but I think an important one. If these plots are somewhat trite, somewhat difficult to follow, somewhat unrealistic at times, if opera is suffering terribly now from an aging population that doesn't necessarily always want change, I mean, perhaps I'll ask a question of you first, Peter. You know, what can you do? I mean, I know what I do. What I did just very recently is bring my 7-year-old son to see Zauberflöte, and he was enchanted and said to me that we must go and see, I'll take him to see the House of the Dead, but we must go and see, why not? I mean, you know, if I put $5 aside every day, there'll be enough money for the shrink later on. But I'm just, you know, he because I read to
we'll
him...
We'll set up a service in the opera.
Take him to see the Nodes because he loves the story.
That should really mess him up.
That will really mess him up, you know. But what are you doing and what can you do? And even my 7-year-old might totally rebel against this early impression of his papa taking him to the opera, though he went quite willingly. What can you do to attract a younger audience? Go ahead.
Well,
it's a question you've been asked 100
what
times.
What we're doing is trying to attract a younger audience. We're also trying, in the face of change, to not alienate the older audience. And that's really why this was not a happy experience for me, in the sense, in the case of Tosca, because to seek controversy or to disturb audience members is the last thing somebody running an opera house wants to do. On the other hand,
is that necessarily true? Because you got a lot of attention.
It is
in some
true.
Way.
Believe me, it's true. It's I'm not. You know, I am not interested in
courting controversy. What I'm interested in is putting on productions at the Met that will draw new audiences into the theater and make it a magical experience for young people, and to make it so that somebody who is both an opera lover and wants to hear the great tradition of great voices preserved at the Met will hear that in this Tosca production, because we have a wonderful cast and the acoustics of the set that were designed by Richard Peduzzi and honors the and supports the voices and the Metropolitan, the glory of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra is all there, and all the musical values and strengths of the Met that have been there for decades are in full glory in this production. And at the same time, for somebody who goes to this, who maybe has never seen Tosca, and who is interested in theatrical realism, will be thrilled by the fact that that an opera production like this can actually be an exciting, revelatory experience for them. And I'm convinced that this opera is doing it. But it's not enough to do with one opera. We have to do
it. Of course.
We have to do with every opera.
And
we have actually 8 new productions this season,
right.
Not 6. And each
more
one
than half a dozen, I say.
Each one of these new productions is an opportunity to captivate and excite new audiences for opera, and at the same time, hopefully, not alienate the audience that we already have. So far, I've been pretty lucky. This one is the first one that I think divided the public so strongly, and we're certainly not looking to divide the public. But on the other hand, we're not interested in compromising this necessary mission to make this opera form alive and fresh, because there's no other answer. The only other way is to passively watch it slowly fade away.
Disintegrate and so many opera houses closing.
People have to understand, Peter wouldn't necessarily say this, but America is a complex country and it often comes in for a lot of criticism, because the stereotype of America is they're ignorant, they're not aware of things, they're not aware of the rest of the world. But the Met, just as an institution, is the most extraordinary artistic institution, absolutely without question, in America, the largest. And it's also one of the most extraordinary ones in the world. It's producing The House of the Dead, The Nose, A New Tosca, these new productions, and maintaining enormous budgets for audiences to come in very large numbers and to see this form, which everyone had declared dead, and then having the temerity to pump them into 42 different countries 8 times a year in these incredible broadcasts, which is changing and creating whole new audiences. And so, thank God people are booing at least on the level that it's there, but it's a very, very extraordinary artistic accomplishment, which, having worked in Europe, they're not accomplishing in Europe in the same way, as much as they will tell us how stupid we are a lot. It's not accomplished in the same way. So it's a pretty good
Patrice,
thing.
Patrice, are we not that stupid then here?
I'm sorry?
Are we not that stupid here in America?
I never thought that.
Yeah. In Europe, what Bart was describing is not happening in opera houses.
Well, you shouldn't ask me, because I'm doing very few operas, and I'm working. And I worked a lot in festivals, so where the standard and the way of working is always different as in a stable opera house, you know. I don't know what to say to your question.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to suggest it. It's just that I think people forget. Americans particularly forget, because we have, by our nature, a little bit insecure, I think, actually how good the thing is. There's some good in what's being accomplished that's pretty different than people might expect.
I want to tell you, in Europe we have completely other problems. We are not problems. The problem is the people would in Europe find this Tosca the most conventional and boring thing. It's because in Europe the problem is different. The people, the director, come money of this. They try to find how to this to construct and make completely that you don't understand the story anymore, and you did. And next time they're going to change the score also, because in the plays they change the text. So this you must understand. This for us is very astonishing, because we don't think in this way. I'm always scandalized
when I go in an opera and I see it's bad work, then I'm very angry because I see so much money for shit. And it's true, it happened. But this is in both sides. It's very much money for shit, conventional shit. There's very much money also for completely stupid progressive shit. You have this both sides, you know. This is the problem you have.
This is a good place on this note, what? On conventional and progressive shit, too.
Yes, so, the problem. What?
I think you've wrapped it up beautifully in those last. So I would like to open it to the public. And what I'd like to encourage, we'll pass around the mic. We had written questions, but better you can read them if you'd like. What I'd like to encourage you to do is to wait for the mic to come around and to ask a question. And in my experience, though I'm not a film proponent of doing that myself, questions can be asked in about 50 seconds or less. To this, if you can pass.
Hi. It seems to me that when you use words like new and unconventional to attract new people, they haven't seen the original. So it seems to me that those might appeal most to people who had already been familiar. So when I started going to operas about 5 years ago, I wanted to see all the classical ones. I wanted to know what's the big deal. I'm very glad I got to see the Zeffirelli Tosca.
The question is...
So, I mean, when you say that in order to attract new audiences, you need to have new productions, I don't feel that at all. I love the production of The Barber of Seville. It seems to me it leads directly into Gilbert and Sullivan, patter songs.
I think I feel complimented by that. Yeah, I understand.
So let's have the next one be a question here.
Good evening. I just have a question for Mr. Gelb quickly. How are we feeling about possibly having a new production for Bohème, which is an older, more like grander, more... it's basically sold out every season since 81. So I was wondering how the management is kind of thinking about... having a new production for that, which is kind of like I would even say it's more holy than Tosca. So I was just curious about that.
The answer to that question is that there's no production at the Met that eventually will not be redone.
Redone, refait.
Do contemporary opera productions so often transpose things into modern dress and settings? Is there a fear that audiences won't get it unless it's literally presented in the terms of our own time?
Who is the question for?
For anybody.
I think any of you should answer that.
For me, it's a question not because we did it in the 19th century and not today. So the question is, I don't understand.
Yeah, Tosca's in period.
No, but in period. Yours in particular, but many directors resort to that.
They have an impulse that they see it. They see the story, the essence of the story in contemporary terms, and they try to find associations and connections with it and put it in that. I don't know.
I tell you something. Well, you know Shakespeare, when he wrote a play like Timon from Athens, who wrote Macbeth, or plays like this. Julius Caesar. He never thought. He thought of England when he lives, and not about Rome. He didn't care, yeah, really. So you cannot make today, if people try to change with Julius Caesar or with Macbeth in the aesthetic, it's normal. It's normal, you can understand it. You cannot... Yeah,
No. It's an interesting question because when I made The Ring, I'm sorry again with The Ring, but I made The Ring, one of the scandals was that the gods were in 19th century costumes. So I said, but why you shouldn't do? You shouldn't do as if it's written, like they are gods. So how they wear, what they wear, what do they wear, the gods? So I thought they should put some contemporary costume of the time of Wagner, you know. So there is also another question by the House of the Dead is normally it is in a Siberian camp in 1860. But the opera was written in 1928, and then since that time, since 1928, we knew a lot of prison and a lot of camps. We knew the Soviet Union, we knew the Nazi camps, and then what does it mean to go back to the Tsar time? You know, I hope to put on stage something who can tell everything, who can talk about all the prison, all the camps of the 20th century. It will be a mistake, a fault, an error to go back to the 19th century, because now the camps we invented in the 20th century are much worse than the Tsarist Russia, you know. So in other words, I don't want even it was an awesome possibility to make everybody in orange and to describe, yeah, Guantanamo, you know.
Exactly,
but between Guantanamo and between the Russia of the 19th century, you have a possibility of describing something that could be related to you, and not necessarily today, but not necessarily in the one century soon before, you know. So we try to find something who is not an obstacle to read exactly the story, and the story can talk to us today.
I mean, Shakespeare's a good example. The only drawing they have of an actual Shakespeare, what they believe to be a Shakespeare production, is Titus Andronicus. And if you looked at the drawing, aside from the fact that it doesn't describe any scene in it, they think of time very differently. It has togas next to contemporary at the time Elizabethan costumes. Yes. Now, if I did a production of Titus Andronicus and put Elizabethan costumes in next to the togas, they'd say I was completely out of my mind. So the idea of this sense that there's this period that has to be observed and followed, it's the response of the artist inside of that that sort of makes sense of it. And time is very complicated.
You can also say, why a person came to me and you say, a tortoise, I don't tell who, but he's very famous, but you have Guantanamo today, and Carpa, it's like Guantanamo. Say yes, and Torto was before Guantanamo, is going to be after Guantanamo. Has been in Russia, is everywhere. I don't make a command to put as director torturing in exactly in, because we know it at the television. You know, this I don't like. This is the aesthetic of the television. They have every day real what's happened in the world, what's happened in Russia, what's happened, I don't know where, in Africa or somewhere. But it's not the point, you know, to make the people say, it's exactly like I saw it yesterday in the television. Because then you became silly. Then you make only recognizing experience which you had and not something who changed.
I have the mic. First, I want to say thank you for Tosca, because the story came through loud and clear. I've probably seen 8 or 9 productions, and I never appreciated it the way I did last week. But the question is, why is there such a hue and cry over Tosca when Sonnambula, which messed up the story completely, did not get such a hue and cry?
And since Mary Zimmerman is not here, I don't think that's a fair question. But it is true that her production of Sonnambula certainly elicited a reaction that was not entirely positive.
How did filming change your ideas about how you were going to direct it?
Everything. What?
How did the idea, the concept of having to create something that was going to be on film.
We don't think about it before.
You don't?
No, I don't.
In fact,
if you think about it before, you cannot start.
And we had, we never discussed the it's going to be broadcast this Saturday,
It was never discussed. There was no adjustments for lighting, makeup, costumes, anything until the last week after the show opened. Because we do not, it's too complicated to put an opera on to begin with, to have to think about the filming of it at the same time.
At the same time, I was thinking about this today. I think you can make in an opera, if you make a live opera, it's always good when you feel that it's a broadcast of a performance, and not to make a wrong film. If you make a wrong film, I don't remember. For me, it was a terrible experience was Lozé's Don Giovanni, because you see that there is a sound who's talking in the studio, the guy is walking, and he say, you don't must sing really, and this is horrible. I think it's when you take it, how you do it, it's a way to documentary a thing for people who cannot go there, and not to try to make a film.
Right, we're not pretending these are films. They are live presentations from the stage.
Mm-hmm. And they're wonderful.
Thank you.
All of them.
Thank you.
Let's take a couple more questions.
I have a microphone here. Isle of Tusca also. For Peter Gelb, when selecting a new production, do you engage the director or the cast first? What role does the director play in selecting the singers?
Well, it's a very delicate balancing act between the director and the conductor and the person in my position too, because we're all trying to find a way to work together to find it's a very difficult process because we are attempting to find performers who please all three sides. So they have to be musically up to the standards of the Met, they have to be theatrically up to the standards of the director, and we talk back and forth. And sometimes you can't do it. For a theater like the Met, which is so transparent in terms of sound, I mean, only the greatest singers can have success on the stage of the Met. In certain cases, operas can't be done because they can't be cast properly. So we try to find the right way.
Take one question there.
One of the new initiatives at the Met is to, I believe, you're commissioning some new musical theater writers to work with the Met, and I know, having theatrical experience, could you just speak to the, the inherent difference between musical theater and opera in your eyes and how that is melding together, and, what would stop you from considering some musical theater repertory in the Met's program?
Well, the thing about the Met is it's a 4,000-seat acoustical house, and there are many theaters in New York which put on musical theater amplified, and we are actually very eagerly pursuing new works. We have a program together with Lincoln Center Theater. In fact, it was mentioned earlier that Nico Muhly, who's sitting here in the front row, has composed an opera, which Bart Scher is working on in a workshop right now, they just came from a session, so we're developing new work which we think will hopefully be on the stage of the Met, and there are so many major contemporary or recent works that have never been produced as operas that the Met didn't pursue, like House of the Dead, or Dr. Atomic, or Satyagraha, or Thomas Addison's The Tempest. There are many works that we have planned that will be new experiences for Met audiences. And quite frankly, musical theater in that house doesn't really make sense. The only time we have so far used amplification, which is what musical theater, of course, needs, is when the composer of an opera like John Adams has included it in his composing.
It's also not a stage for the spoken voice.
Not a good one.
It's really not. Yeah, it's just really not an easy place for the spoken voice to work, because suddenly the thing just gets so small, mm-hmm. and if it's amplified, you can't get any balance between the two things. It's built for a certain kind of experience,
right.
And the relationship between Lincoln Center Theater and the Met. I mean, who knows if Michael John Lacusa is going to write a musical or an opera? He doesn't know when he gets his commission.
Right, that's a good point. Part of our program is that we leave it open to what the ultimate type of work it is. So it could end up, one of these commissions could end up at the Beaumont.
Let's take a couple more questions.
Good evening. I have a question for Peter Willab regarding the HD production. The question is how the camera work is planned for these broadcasts, because it seems to be the DVD productions are much better than the camera work when it's broadcast. I don't know why and for reason, but it looks, for me at least, like more like a soccer game than actually opera production when you see HD.
I'm not quite sure I follow the question. You're saying it looks more like a soccer game?
I'm asking about the how well the camera work is planned, cinematography is planned for this broadcast, because it's kind of a little bit hectic and doesn't represent like as well as usual DVD production does.
Well, you know, it is live. So because it's live, there is the possibility for sometimes a camera to miss a shot, but that's a small price to pay for the thrill and excitement of being connected to the Met live. And I think the reason why almost 2 million people watch these transmissions in movie theaters in 40 countries last year is because the idea of being connected live to the Met and witnessing these great performances is an experience that is almost as good as being in the opera house itself, not quite as good as being there. But the price of being live, just like if you were watching a soccer match, is sometimes the camera is not in the right place. We believe that our cameras mostly are in the right places. And one of the things that we have done with these transmissions is to make them far more, I think, visually interesting than most DVDs in opera houses, because we, since the team that produces these live transmissions is also the same producers who run the opera house itself, we take license and liberties with the camera work that goes beyond what other opera houses have ever done. For example, in this Tosca that we're showing on Saturday, there is a remote-controlled camera that just appears over the edge of the stage that's on a rail that can track all the way across the stage back and forth, providing these kind of cinematic dolly shots. No opera house has ever done anything like that. And we also have a camera on an arm that can go up and down on one side of the house. And we also have cameras backstage, which provide kind of live reportage. You know, as you know, if you've seen them, this Saturday, Susan Graham, who is starring in our revival of Rosencavalier, is our behind-the-scenes reporter. And she will be interviewing Carita Macula as she comes off the stage. So and the audiences in the movie theaters love seeing diva reporters at work interviewing their peers. There are sacrifices, but we think the advantages outweigh the disadvantages.
Let's take one last question.
Since you've become the general manager of the opera, the number of new productions has increased hugely. And this year we're doing 8, and last year we did 6, the previous year a similar number. Just statistically speaking, we're going to have failures. And tonight we've decided that the failures will not be judged by booing on opening nights and by negative critiques by people writing in the newspapers. How will we know when we have a bad production? Since statistically speaking, every opera house has, even the Metropolitan Opera House, will eventually have a bad production.
Well, I think that it was interesting hearing Patrice talking about his production of The Ring in Bayreuth and how it was first vilified in some quarters, and then later on was considered to be a enduring legendary success. I think that the main criteria is the public, and I think if the public, you know, I feel very strong as these directors do. I feel. And I think that's why we get along with each other, is we all have the same goal, which is to lead the public and excite and stimulate the public. And if the public does not come to the production, then I guess we would consider it not to be as successful as we would have liked. So we have to hope that the public will come. And if it does come and enjoys it, then I think that is an indication that certainly a good indication that it was a success. It's no good, certainly, to work in a vacuum where if I think and the director thinks that we've had a great success and nobody else does, that wouldn't, you know, we may be right, but it wouldn't be very convincing.
So I tell you only one thing. A little bit, I was afraid that the people like too much the Tosca.
Well, your fears did not come true.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, you must understand it. It would be a problem. Don't you think so?
I do.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.